Hello and welcome to our podcast, Baby Baking and Kid Raising, hosted by Eliza Carr, a passionate midwife, mama and founder of Bump and Bub.
As well as Dr. Joseph Scroy, an obstetrician, gynecologist, fertility specialist, as well as a dad of three.
Together, we'll be discussing topics from fertility through to parenthood and the journey in between.
Each week, we'll be joined by inspiring guests to share their journeys through fertility, pregnancy, birth, and parenthood, as well as educational episodes from us, a midwife and an obstetrician. Welcome back to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. Today, we are joined by beautiful Maddie Rowan. Maddie is bravely sharing her journey of loss and grief with us today. Maddie and her husband had what's known as a missed miscarriage, which we'll talk about in depth. Maddie also lost her mother and is very vocal about that and has become an incredible advocate and support for others facing this. At the moment, though, you're sitting here with your beautiful 24-week rainbow baby.
Yeah.
And absolutely glowing and looking so beautiful. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, your husband, and what you do?
Yeah, thank you for having me, firstly. I'm 29 years old. I'm a physiotherapist living with my husband on the Bellarine Peninsula. Mm-hmm. So we're very lucky there.
Yeah.
And we have our first bub on the way. So 24 weeks at the moment. Yeah. And yes, feeling much better than I was early days. Mm. So, yeah, that's me in a nutshell. My mum passed away 10 years ago this year from a disease called Huntington's disease.
Yeah.
So she was 47 when she passed away. I was 19. Wow. So, yeah, we had quite a few difficult years from about the age or her sort of mid-30s, I guess. Where she really presented with the symptoms and challenges of Huntington's disease and made her way through to 47, where we unfortunately lost her.
Yeah. So just do you mind explaining just for people who don't know, what is Huntington's disease and how do you get it?
Yeah. It's a neurological disease. So it's essentially a defective gene that you are born with. Mm. So it gets passed down from a defective parent. You have 50% chance of inheriting the disease if you are the child of a parent with the disease. So I always sort of try to explain it. I guess genes always come in pairs and you might want to correct me. I could be a bit off with this, but my interpretation, layman's terms, is genes come in pairs. So my father, so everyone has a Huntington gene, but my father, he had a pair of good ones, whereas mum had in her pair, she had one defective and one good one. So dad was always going to pass me on a good one. He could only pass on a good one, whereas mum, it was 50-50 whether I was going to get her defective gene or her good gene. So I was very lucky to find out at about 23, I think I was, when I went through testing that I don't have the disease, so I can't pass it on any further. Either.
So it's interesting. I have a few patients who know that their parents have got Huntington's disease.
Yes.
But they don't want to be tested.
Yes.
But they want the embryos to be tested.
Yes.
So sort of like they don't want to know because unfortunately it is a sentence. There's not much we can do in terms of Huntington's disease.
Mm.
And as you said before, you know, I liken genes like factories. You've got two factories. One factory that produces a great product and one factory that doesn't produce such a great product.
Correct.
And if you get the factory that doesn't produce the great product, in this case with Huntington's disease, it leads to this neurological condition, as you said. But there's one thing that we can do when we do have a genetically inherited condition such as Huntington's disease is we can then try to eliminate that in any offspring that happen in the future. So fortunately for you, that wasn't something that you needed necessarily to consider.
Yeah. I did know of those options and I was very aware. There's obviously a lot of counselling that you go through when you're going through the testing process. So I was very aware of those options if I were to come back positive.
Do you have any other siblings?
I have two brothers, but they're actually my stepbrothers.
Ah, okay.
So I was the only child to my mum.
Yep, gotcha.
Yeah, so it's done in our family now, which is really pleasing and we're very, very blessed to be in that situation because it's obviously not that straightforward for everybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a horrible disease. I often sort of describe it. I think there's a quote out there, Charles Sabine is a sufferer himself, and he describes it as a combination of Parkinson's, which really attributes the physical side of Huntington's, the Alzheimer's, because you get very forgetful and your memory is quite impacted, schizophrenia, because you lose a lot of your, like, emotional regulation, and he also throws in cancer as well there, just from that sort of, I think, suffering sort of point of view as well. So
horrendous.
It's not as straightforward. It is. It's awful. And it's obviously progressive. So you are born with it, but it only comes on in sort of adulthood, and then it progresses to a point where, you know, my mum, she couldn't talk. Towards the end of her life, she couldn't walk by herself. She couldn't feed herself, you know, shower, just your basic sort of everyday things that we do and take for granted, that she couldn't control any of that towards the end of her life. So
And was that one of the reasons why you may have chosen to go into physiotherapy, do you think?
Look, I think it is potentially in a roundabout way, yeah. I think I always felt as though I was health orientated at school, and always had a passion for that, but I think that was driven sort of externally and maybe subconsciously a little bit as well. I was never going to be a doctor, and I sort of tossed up with nursing as well for a little bit there, but I think probably more from that physical point of view was where physio came into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's change direction slightly and chat through your fertility journey, the time that you decided that you were potentially ready to start a family with your husband and, that whole process. I know your first pregnancy wasn't straightforward and it was quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was.
And, I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, we had discussed having babies from, you know, very early on in our relationship. So it was always something that we wanted to do. We sort of thought about it the year before we got married, but I was sort of progressing with my career quite a bit at the time and wanted to sort of focus on that. And, you know, my husband was obviously supportive of that. And then we got engaged and then we got married and, you know, all of that sort of took over our brain space for that little bit of time. So after we got married, which was December last year, we were basically ready to just, you know, not try, but let's just, you know, make that conscious decision now to go ahead and see what happens. So we were really fortunate in that we fell pregnant really quickly. So we fell pregnant just after our wedding, essentially, in late December, and unfortunately found out at around 7 weeks that we'd had a missed miscarriage. So
how did you find that out?
So we were at our dating scan so I'd not had sort of consistent menstrual periods before we had started trying. So I was a little bit iffy with dates at the time. So I think the dating scan was going to be really important. We had a ballpark and we thought that I was around those 7 weeks, but we weren't 100% sure. And especially because we were just, you know, being really casual about it, and we weren't sort of wanting to make anything too rigid or too structured. We just wanted to see what, you know, the world wanted to bring us and what was meant for us. So we were very casual about it, which is us to a T.
you give off the aura of kind of, sort of relaxed, calm, human.
Yeah.
I was the opposite. I was like, okay, well, today's the day. Perfect. Let me get my calendar.
Yeah. Okay. No, so we were, very, very much the opposite and just sort of wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah,
so,
amazing.
And just for people to know what a miscarriage is. So this is where we have a pregnancy that unfortunately is continuing despite there not being necessarily two things. Number one, either a baby's heartbeat that's easily visible, or alternatively there's a sac but without a fetal pole or a baby that you can actually see that's starting to grow. And there's certain criteria that we use on ultrasound scan to determine specifically whether a missed miscarriage has occurred. So it's where your body, for all intents and purposes, still producing all the pregnancy hormones, you still feel pregnant, but unfortunately the pregnancy's not continued to a point where there's a, you know, a baby with a heartbeat. And sometimes it may take us one scan and possibly even a scan a week or two later just to determine specifically whether that's the case, particularly when you're not sure of your menstrual dates.
So that, that was exactly what had happened to us. So when I initially found out that I was pregnant, you know, GP, blood tests, all of that kind of jazz. So everything was tracking exactly how it was meant to. HCG was rising and, you know, there was no cause of concern sort of whatsoever. So until we'd got to that dating scan, I felt pregnant. You know, I had some symptoms. I was quite fatigued. I wasn't necessarily nauseous, which is different to my current pregnancy. So comparing the two now, they were quite different in those early stages, which, you know, might have potentially been an indicator. But having been my first pregnancy, I didn't have anything to compare it to. So I definitely felt the fatigue side of things and I definitely felt pregnant. I think you just always sort of have that internal monologue that there's something going on. So it wasn't until we got to our dating scan at 7 weeks that we were told there was no heartbeat. We were told to come back in 2 weeks just to confirm. So we were told they didn't necessarily want to say that the pregnancy wasn't there and wasn't viable. I think that was more so around my menstrual dates because they thought, well, if the dates are quite out and we have got it, you know, a matter of weeks wrong, we wouldn't expect to hear a heartbeat if you are earlier than what we're thinking. So they essentially they didn't want to terminate anything. They didn't want to make a call. Well, that was the impression that I got. They didn't want to make a call just in case, you know, if I came back in 2 weeks' time and there had been a development and we may have been able to see a bit more. So on the ultrasound sort of screen, the picture was only up for, you know, not very long. I didn't get to sort of catch a whole lot. I still have the vision. I can still see it as soon as I close my eyes. But my husband actually saw that I was measuring at about, I think it was like 7 weeks and 3 days, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the sac of the pregnancy. So that had definitely continued and that was what was growing, and I was obviously producing all of the hormones to continue the pregnancy and to grow the pregnancy. But there was just nothing that was growing along with it, and my body hadn't acknowledged that because I had no signs of a miscarriage. I, you know, had no bleeding, and as I said, you know, all of the bloods and everything were coming back routine and nothing to be of concern. So it wasn't until then that we were told there was something a little bit off, and then to confirm that 2 weeks later. So
and what was that? I can imagine that was an agonizing two awful. Weeks.
So yeah. awful.
Because you're thinking, I'm still feeling pregnant. What my bloods are still normal. Yeah. We're just waiting and obviously hopeful.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that was, you know, there was that little glimmer of hope that it was really challenging to hold on to that. Of course you want to hold on to that. You want, like, we wanted this baby and, you know, seeing the positive pregnancy test and having all of the blood tests and everything come back fine, it's, you know, you feel as though you've got your bub and
you're
starting this journey. And
I think it's something as well that we don't necessarily talk about very much. Yeah. When you think of a miscarriage, you think, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you've started bleeding or there's been these signs and these symptoms. But a miscarriage is something that most women potentially have never heard of.
No, and I'd never – exactly. Yeah. I'd never heard of it. So I was really confused. I mean, I work in healthcare, but this felt like a whole nother language. Like this felt so foreign to me, and I did not understand. And so those 2 weeks between the two scans, I just kept going between – mindsets, you know. I was thinking, well, you know, if there's no heartbeat, then, you know, there mustn't be anything there. But then, you know, and we've lost the baby. But then why is my body carrying on? Like it's holding on to something. So maybe there's hope, you know. Maybe it's doing that for a reason, because it's trying or something will come of it. So it was super challenging. And I had spent that whole 2 weeks just Googling everything.
Yeah.
Like I just couldn't help it. Yeah. I wanted something to give me some kind of indicator or, you know, I was so on the fence, you know. We'd told a few people, we hadn't told family, but we'd told a few close friends early on that I was pregnant. So that was the other weird thing in those 2 weeks, you know, do we tell them that we've lost it, but have we actually lost it? Or like, what do we tell them? Because we were in this weird limbo land of 2 weeks as well, not knowing what was going on for us. So
and it's so all-consuming as well.
I think people often ask me, you know, when should we tell people that we're pregnant?
Yeah.
And I always say to them, you know, tell people who you know will support you.
Yeah,
no matter what.
You know, no matter what happens in terms of whether the pregnancy continues, whether you need to make really hard decisions about the pregnancy.
Yeah.
Because even in that two-week window waiting time,
that's
an opportunity to speak to those people and say, hey, listen, this is what I'm going through.
Yeah.
And also because we do, unfortunately, and it doesn't make it any easier, and I don't really say this to patients unless they ask me, but, you know, miscarriage, unfortunately, is very common.
Mm.
I mean, one in four pregnancies will end in a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And so every pregnancy announcement you see, or every three pregnancy announcements you see, there's also one woman, unfortunately, who's going through a pregnancy loss.
Absolutely.
And it's very easy for us as healthcare professionals to dismiss a pregnancy loss at 6 or 7 or 8 weeks as being insignificant because, you know, what, you only just missed your period. What do you get on with it, right?
Mm.
But in actual fact, it is that sense of loss of hope of having a newborn, of seeing that newborn grow up because you're excited about the prospect of being parents.
Definitely, yeah. And I think I was one of those women that I didn't feel as though I'd heard, you know, many people around me that had miscarriages. And I know those stats, you know, especially now after the fact, I know those stats of 1 in 4 pregnancies that will end in miscarriage. But I almost felt like I felt different. I didn't feel alone. I definitely felt supported, but I felt odd, like the odd one out, and I sort of felt a little bit, you know, inferior, and I guess also not knowing in those 2 weeks what was going on and not knowing, you know, what to tell people, that was also really hard.
Mm.
And I completely respect what you're saying in that, you know, tell those people that you'll want around you if you do need to make tough decisions or have tough conversations. But I didn't even know how to have those conversations at that time because I just thought, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
So what happened at the 2 week mark?
So they didn't put any scans on the screen, so we didn't see anything. They said if we wanted to that they would, but they essentially just could confirm straight away that there was still no development on the first scan. And also I think my measurements had started to shrink, so there was an indication that I was slowly, like my body was slowly acknowledging the pregnancy loss rather than continuing to still grow from there. So that was sort of it. In the scan, they just said, look, we can confirm it now. And I was essentially referred off straight back to my GP. So I was a bit of a planner and I'd already booked a GP appointment that day for after the scan because I just thought, even if it's great news and we get told that, you know, there is a bub and everything is on track and it was just a bit of a scare to start us off with, I just wanted to have an appointment there just in case, because I knew, I think it was a Friday, and I just thought, if we get told any kind of news that, you know, I just need some kind of reassurance from a medical professional, you know, I want to see her straight away and just understand what's going on. So I actually think I had the appointment booked the same day, which I'm grateful for my forward planning now, because I think, you know, if I had to have waited a number of hours or days or whatever it was, I think that would have made it even tougher after waiting 2 weeks for that.
Sure. Scan. So what were the options that were given to you at that point?
Yeah, so I was presented with three. The first one was just wait. So because I had started to shrink and there was some evidence of that, they were saying that your body is obviously slowly acknowledging that you have miscarried, so it should naturally happen. We can't tell you when. You could wait months, you could wait days or hours. So that was option one. Option two was taking, I think it was a course of tablets that would bring on the miscarriage. Again, they couldn't necessarily give me a much of a timeline with that, and so I sort of thought, I guess, that if my body hadn't acknowledged the pregnancy loss early on, then would it be a challenge for it to acknowledge a pregnancy loss even with, you know, this medication? And I just sort of thought, is my body being stubborn, or, you know, why has it continued to try and grow this pregnancy? And I just didn't have much faith in that, I guess, going smoothly. Mm. And then my third option was a DNC, so going in, having a general anaesthetic, and surgically having the pregnancy removed.
Did you, I know... a lot of women who have had a miscarriage often feel almost resentment towards their own body. They almost feel angry. They can't understand. And it is such a hard thing, especially you got pregnant straight away. You know, like, what is my body doing? Why is it not registering? What's happening? Why do I even have to have these discussions about my options here?
Yeah,
did you feel that at all?
Yeah, I felt a lot of confusion. Like, I was disappointed and just thought, why is my body hanging on to this? I think that really... like, it really affected me in those 2 weeks waiting for that second scan, because I just thought there has to be a reason why it's held on. And now knowing a lot more about missed miscarriages, you know, I'd never heard of them. I'd heard of miscarriages, and my interpretation of that was very basic in that, you know, as you sort of mentioned before, it's something that comes on suddenly and, you know, you start bleeding or whatever it might be. So this was kind of a whole new concept of miscarriage for me that I'd never heard of or sort of understood. So I was quite frustrated. I just thought, you know, why is my body holding on to something that's not there? And, leading us on with this hope that we had a bub and it actually, you know, wasn't there. So it wasn't that I was angry, but it was just the confusion.
Yeah.
I guess I'm one of those people that sort of thinks everything happens for a reason. So I thought if I'm holding on to something, I feel like there has to be a reason for that. You know, why has it done that? So I was confused. Yeah.
So what was the follow-up after the DNC? It obviously had the DNC.
Yeah.
What was the follow-up after that?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. So as I said, after the first scan, they said, you know, these are your three options, the just wait and see, the tablets or the surgery. So I was really lucky having my GP appointment that afternoon, because I went and saw her and said, I want to go ahead with the surgery.
Yeah.
I don't want to wait. I feel like I've waited long enough. And if we have the confirmation now that there's no pregnancy, I just want my body to, you know, essentially be able to start fresh.
Yeah.
I thought there's going to be a healing process. There's going to be, you know, there's going to be time that my body needs after this. And I don't want to drag that on any longer, I guess. So when I went to my GP, I said, I want to go ahead with the DNC. So she had to put in the referral to the public hospital in Geelong. I was going through a private obstetrician, but because we hadn't got to our first appointment, I hadn't met my obstetrician. I had appointments booked in the future I think it was my first one was going to be about 10 weeks, but because I hadn't met them, I hadn't had any correspondence other than booking in these appointments, I didn't even think about reaching out to them when we had confirmation about the miscarriage. It just didn't seem like they'd been involved yet, so I didn't have any thought of reaching out to them, which now being in the system and I know I could have done that now, but it was never even presented to me. It was never even reach out to your who's your obstetrician, you know, are you going public or private? That it was never a question.
It's an important point you raise, because often people will book and see me and I might not see them until 8 or 10 weeks. But you're right, the pregnancy care actually starts from the moment that you ring up or you've made even a decision to go privately for obstetric care. It's one of the reasons in part why I also encourage people to come and do a preconception counselling appointment, because it does allow you the opportunity to meet with the obstetrician, establish a rapport, make sure they're the right person for you.
Definitely.
That they're going to be able to care for you, not only the good times, because that's catching the baby, that's awesome, but also in some of these bad times as well. And you know, I see any pregnancy loss as quite significant historically, and probably, you know, even in terms of general medical practice, we tend not to investigate pregnancy losses, miscarriages, early miscarriages until you've had three. And for me, it's a bit too much. I think one's enough. And there are some reasons for miscarriages that can be preventable. And if you know about that after the first one, well, you're going to do something about it. So I always want to be involved as a practitioner very early on, even if you've not seen me and you've had a miscarriage, because that allows us the ability to see and rule out if there's any causes for miscarriage. I tend to think about miscarriages as angels, and angels that are going to guide us hopefully to the next pregnancy. Yeah. And I use that little acronym ANGELS to sort of tell me, you know, what are the things we need to look out for in terms of trying to prevent a future pregnancy. So the A stands for anatomy, the structure of the uterus, making sure that the uterus is a normal structure. When we look at a uterus, it's a bit like having a room. You want to make sure that the room's just four walls and nothing else inside. Yeah. So if there's anything that's obstructing those four walls and the room, that might be a problem. So we often think about things like a uterine septum, which is like a partition within the room, or a fibroid, which is like putting a fireplace in the room, a big dirty fireplace that's bellowing out smoke and hot fire. So that needs to be – these are things that can be removed.
Yeah.
We also look at autoimmune conditions. These are conditions where your body produces antibodies that potentially attack a pregnancy. And so we want to screen for those to know that they're not there, the ability for them to potentially cause a miscarriage. We want to know about them so we can prevent it. And then the N stands for nutrition. What you guys can do as a couple to maximize the chances of a successful pregnancy: diet, Mediterranean-based diet, lots of plant-based foods, limited amount of red meats and white meats, but, you know, predominantly just getting good nutrition. Then genetics. That's predominantly one of the major issues for chromosomal abnormalities. So, you know, we know of Down syndrome. That's where the pregnancy has an additional chromosome 21. But any rearrangement of chromosomes can cause a miscarriage. So knowing that you and your partner had normal chromosomes would be important. The E stands for endocrine issues, so hormonal issues, thyroid disease, diabetes. These contribute to miscarriage as well. And then lifestyle issues, making sure we're not drinking out of plastic water bottles because they have hormone-disrupting chemicals in them that can cause issues. But, you know, not smoking, making sure we're reducing our alcohol consumption. And then the last couple of things are sperm DNA fragmentation. The sperm, we always think it's a woman's fault or the woman's problem, but, you know, it's a sperm and an egg issue. And when we think about sperm, we know that the sperm gets stored in the testes for a short while before it comes out into the ejaculate. And during that period of time, it can be exposed to free radicals and oxidative stress that can damage the DNA and subsequently lead to miscarriage. So that's important to know about. And the last thing is sometimes we don't know. None of those angel criteria things are met, but sometimes there's something called chronic endometritis, which is a chronic inflammatory process that occurs within the uterus. And if you've got inflammation that's there within the uterus, it's like one warring party versus another warring party, and you're putting a baby in no man's land. It gets caught up in the crossfire, and that can lead to a miscarriage. So we need to rule out if there's any chronic endometritis, any chronic inflammatory process. And so, you know, a lot of what I do for women who have had miscarriages is support them through that emotional journey that's happened in terms of not only their mental but also their physical health. Then also try to establish, is there anything that we're concerned about that might be there that would predispose them to another miscarriage? But then also laying a foundation for what's going to happen in the next pregnancy. And we do know that, for example, doing frequent regular ultrasound scans in that first trimester, week 6, week 7, week 8, week 9, week 10, so on and so forth, reduces the risk of miscarriage. Not because the ultrasound does anything fancy, but it's this TLC being able to positively reinforce that the pregnancy is continuing and everything's looking fine. So I think reaching out, if you are choosing to go privately, reaching out to your obstetrician. I had, in actual fact, the first podcast I ever did was with someone called Monique Bowley, who was from the Mamma Mia Network, and she'd had a meeting. I'm telling you something that's not confidential because she published it on a podcast. But she talked about the fact that she'd had a miscarriage, and she walked out of her ultrasound not knowing what to do. And she just, because she'd done the podcast with me, she contacted me directly. She wasn't even planning to see me for pregnancy. But she knew that we'd done this podcast. So just reaching out, if you are planning to go privately, reaching out so that, you know, you're there to support. And then she's now gone on and had two beautiful bubbas whilst under my care, which is quite nice. But it's important that, you know, we as healthcare practitioners, particularly in obstetrics and midwifery, we're there for the fun times. Catching babies, love it, but we're also there for the losses, you know, the pregnancy losses, whether they occur at 28 weeks or whether they occur at 5 or 6 weeks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hearing all of that would have made the world of difference. Like, as you said, what was the follow-up after the DNC? Literally nothing. I was discharged that day after having the procedure, and that was it. I wasn't followed up by anyone at the hospital. Obviously, my Ob wasn't involved because I'd never even been sort of given that thought to reach out to them. So
I've got to say that when I mean, this is just maybe if Tracy's listening because she's out there, she's your obstetrician.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
One thing I do, if I have a patient who cancels obstetric care from me, I always give them a call.
Yeah.
Because it's unusual for a woman to have booked and then not to come to the first appointment. So I always give them a call, not because saying, oh, why the hell haven't you come and see me? It's more about I'm making sure that they're okay. Because often you'll ring up and say, I'm just cancelling my obstetric appointment. You don't even talk to the receptionist about what the issue is. And often it is because, in fact, the vast majority of times it is because they've just had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And that might be just, but it's so important to know about it because then we're talking about those whole angel thing.
Absolutely.
And trying to work out if there's anything we can do to prevent it in the future.
And I felt like, you know, the one comment that was constantly made after the miscarriage was, you fell pregnant once, you know, really easily, you'll fall pregnant easily again.
Yeah.
But my mind was going to, how do you know?
Exactly.
Like what if there's something wrong? And all of those angel, everything that you just said, that was in layman's terms all going through my head, you know, what if there is something wrong? What if it's me? What if it's my husband? What if there's something that's just that's not right? And I think it was at our second scan that we were told, you know, there's nothing that you could have done to change this. It was always going to happen. You know, you haven't done anything wrong. It's not you. You haven't caused this. So that was really honed in. But there was, as I said, I just, and maybe that is a little bit of my healthcare background as well, I just thought there could be so many things, I'm sure, that could potentially have been in the way of this pregnancy. And I was scared trying again because I thought, you know, and I had been, you know, not blown off, but I'd been told, you know, you've only lost one pregnancy, you know, we need to wait and see how you go before we start investigating
things. Let's wait till the third.
Yes, literally.
Just ridiculous.
Let's wait till the third and when you're at breaking point.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was driving me nuts because I am kind of one of those people that I like to tick boxes and, you know, I just like to make sure everything is covered. Yeah. And I felt like, you know, if my body wasn't ready or if something was wrong between the, you know, my husband and I, that if I put us through this again or if I even put myself through it again, just because I was told not to worry about investigating anything or not to worry about, you know, we'll fall pregnant again, it'll be easy, you know, it was easy the first time, it'll happen. I would have been so challenged if we went through that a consecutive time. So to think about the women that do go through that a minimum of 3 times before they can start getting, you know, even some basic blood work or something done, I just think it's
horrendous.
It is. Mm. It's one of those pitfalls I see to our healthcare system. And it would have been really reassuring to have just sat down and been like, okay, let's work our way through these things, you know, ANG, let's go
even
through all of them.
Even just to know someone was on your side.
Yeah, and I did. So I actually reached out to she was my gynecologist, but she's also an obstetrician. And I reached out to her when we were thinking about trying again. So after the DNC, I was told to have at least 2 or 3 normal periods before we'd start trying again.
So just in terms of evidence for that, there's no evidence for that?
Yeah.
So in actual fact, as long as the pregnancy hormone level has come down to 0, and in my practice, my nurses and midwives and I will follow the pregnancy hormone level until it goes down to 0, with your next period, you can get pregnant.
Yeah.
So in actual fact, there are some situations where a woman has had a bleed because we've done a DNC or they've had the miscarriage.
Mm.
The pregnancy hormone level has travelled down to 0. She's ovulated and not even had another period and got pregnant.
Mm.
So it's happened multiple times. So
there
used to be this philosophy that, you need to wait 3 or 4. Some older obstetricians and gynecologists say up to 6 months.
Mm.
But the evidence shows, in actual fact, your chance of an ongoing pregnancy is greatest in the first 3 months after you've had a miscarriage.
Mm. Yep.
And so if you were to leave people and you were to say to the other group of people, hey, listen, wait 3 to 6 months, the group that's already gone off and started getting pregnant again have already they're already pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a bit of a misnomer.
Yes, yeah. And I've sort of come across that after the fact as well. I have a good friend of mine who's a midwife, and she was sort of like, Mads, you know, if you are getting your period again, just, you know, you're ovulating, so go for it. Mm. So I was sort of feeling as though I was getting conflicting information as well, and I reached out to my gynecologist. As I said, she was an obstetrician as well, and I just said, can you just hold my hand? Like, I just need someone to walk alongside me through this, because I was just so nervous. I felt like I didn't have I had so much information that I was confused what to do with it, because, you know, it was all quite different.
And Google it late at night.
And you Google it. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so I said to her, like, I just need you to hold my hand and walk me through it, because she had sort of said, you know, we're not going to go through doing all vigorous testing and stuff like that just yet. Let's just see how you go, you know, the second time around. So I was so fortunate and lucky to fall pregnant again. It was sort of the second month that we'd tried.
Yeah.
And she was scanning me regularly from even 4 weeks. Like, it was the day I was due for my period, and we did a scan, and she could just see, you know, the thickening was where it needed to be. And we scanned every week up until I think, yeah, we heard the heartbeat at about 7 weeks with her, and then did the dating scan and went on the process as you usually would from there. So we did have a little bit of extra TLC in those earlier days with the second pregnancy with this one. But that was because I was the one that reached out to ask for that. That was never presented to me you know, the idea was never even just given to me about, if you want to do that, that's an option you can. It was purely because I was just, you know, racking my own brain thinking I just need a professional to help me through this. Yeah, I don't know what to do, and I don't want to repeat anything.
The first time we can actually see a baby's heartbeats at 6 weeks and 2 days. So some of the reassurance that happens between then and the first scan is just making sure the pregnancy hormone level's increasing.
Yeah.
Often I'll do a scan, particularly if a woman's had an ectopic pregnancy, where there's a pregnancy occurring outside the uterus, particularly in the tubes.
Yeah.
I'll do a pregnancy scan if the pregnancy hormone level's above 1,500 or 1,500, because we should be able to see then a small little sac in the uterus.
Yeah.
But otherwise, really, the first scan, the big scan, is at 6 weeks and 2 days. Definitely should be able to see a little baby heartbeat by then, and then those regular scans afterwards to be positively reassuring us. But that pregnancy hormone rising is really nice too, you know, knowing that it's doubling over the course of the 2 weeks is quite nice to know as well.
And my, she's not my obstetrician, but she's an obstetrician, the one that was holding our hand. She, you know, was texting me through as soon as she was getting our blood work, my blood work back. And, you know, she was throwing these numbers at me, and she was like, these are really good numbers, you know, because they meant nothing to
me. Smiley emojis afterwards.
Yeah, lots of them. Yeah, I think all the thumbs up.
The hard thing here, and it's what we've seen kind of throughout all of these episodes, is how good in a situation like this the private system can be. And not to discredit the public, I've only ever worked in the public system, but that would never happen in the public system.
Well, it can't. It's under-resourced.
But it's such a hard thing, because obviously we're sitting here chatting about this, and I feel like it's obviously incredibly privileged to be able to do that.
But the other thing is, I think the other thing to say is that you can go and see somebody just for the first 13 weeks.
If you can afford it.
Yeah, if you can afford it. Yeah,
see, that's the thing. Yeah. We were in a very privileged position that I just thought, this is worth anything right now, because, you know, for my mental health and, you know, for our relationship and for every reason I could have possibly thought, you know, I was willing to pay any money to have someone just hold our hand and help us through it. But people don't have that luxury at all. It's not an option.
So we're into our second pregnancy now. Would you say 24 weeks?
Yeah.
Magnificent.
Yeah.
How's it been going thus far?
It was an awful first trimester. So about 5 weeks, I started to get really sick. And I think it was about 9 or 10 weeks I was in ED on a drip and told I had hyperemesis. So that was yucky. And as I said, quite different to the first pregnancy. So
was there a point in this pregnancy, like once you got past that 7 weeks-ish, did you start to feel reassured? Did you start to feel calmer? How was, obviously, pregnancy after loss is a huge range of emotions.
Definitely. I still don't think I can say I'm calm about it now. I still I am going through a private obstetrician, so I see her, I think it's every 4 weeks. And the anxiety I get waiting to hear that heartbeat on every scan that she does, I don't think that's going to go away until I've got the baby in my arms.
Yeah. Can you feel bub move yet or not yet?
Yes, I can. Much. And that was quite early as well. I think I could feel bub at about 19 weeks. So. Yeah. And that's amazing, and that's reassuring for me. Yeah. But again, I think I'm on edge that, you know, any little bit of underactivity, I'm really alerted to.
Of course.
I don't think that angst is going to go away until Bobby's here. I think every scan, you know, I go through, I'm going to be waiting to hear that heartbeat. You know, even the first time I did hear the heartbeat, I was, you know, is it a good one? Is it, you know, are we
is
good?
Everything
okay? Yeah.
It's actually one of the things that I always do when I do a scan is the first thing I always say is everything's looking good.
Yes.
Because you're sitting there, and I wonder if you do this as well, and a lot of my patients do that, look at my face. And, of course, I'm actually studying things really, like my eyes squint because I'm looking at something and they go, something wrong. I'm going, no, I'm just looking at my eyesight. I'm 48 now. I can't see.
Give me a break.
Exactly. So it's really important. And I think part of the art is actually sort of sitting there and just saying, hey, everything's all right. Look, everything's great.
Yeah.
Particularly that for those first few scans where we can see straight away that there's a heartbeat and we know everything's great. But, you know, it might take us 20 seconds just to size everything up and then we want to show you. But but that's too long. Those 20 seconds are like agonizing, like 2 years.
Yeah.
Especially if you've had a loss.
Exactly.
And I think we had at our, is it the 21-week scan, which is like your morphology scan, and the sonographer said something about my placenta is really far away. And I thought,
from what?
Is that what do I do? Like, how do I get it close? And she's like, no, you want it to be far away. And I was like, oh, like, you could have started with that. Yeah, I was like, that freaked me out. I was like, I didn't know that it's a good thing to have your place. And so,
We make a lot of assumptions, don't we? But I'm sure you do in your practice.
Exactly.
You make a lot of assumptions that people just know what we're talking about.
Yes, yeah. And so, and, you know, she's saying your placenta is, you know, anterior, and I'm thinking, well, is it meant to be? Like, is that good? So,
normal?
So everything, you know, I think I'm heightened to probably that wording. It may not trigger me as much, I guess, if we hadn't had a loss prior. I'm not sure. I might still overanalyze it because I'm one of those kinds of people. But
so do you know the gender of this bubba?
We don't.
Oh, so it's going to be a surprise.
You've
definitely got Eliza and Joe as names.
Need a bit of name in tow.
Desperately, we're wanting a baby baking and kid raising baby to be named after us.
We might have to do like
for
a
show. Might have to wait for a few seasons, but you know, who knows?
In one day, I had two babies named after me. There were three babies that were born over the course of the day.
Yeah.
And I had two of the babies were named after me
in one day.
And I said to the couple in the middle, I walked in after, you know, on the first day after they've had their babies, I did my postnatal ward round, and I walked into the couple and I said, hey, listen, I'm really disappointed in you guys. And they said, why? Well, we did it.
What have we done?
I said, you didn't name your baby after the first couple did and the third
and
did, but you guys didn't.
Oh, my God. Clearly you're more impressionable than me. I've never had someone call their baby Eliza.
But Joe's not really like, it's not a really common name, Joe. Not, well, it's, maybe it's coming now.
I think it's pretty common.
Well, no. What I mean is not for this generation.
Not for this generation. More common than Eliza, I tell you that.
But Eliza's cool. It's a cool name.
It's cool. I actually love, so my obstetrician is Tracy and my mum's name was Tracy.
Yeah.
So I love that already.
That's beautiful.
You could call her
TJ.
Yeah, Tracy Jr.
Joe.
Tracy Jr. Oh, no, you could call it Tracy Joe, but it was meant Tracy Jr.
So, or Tracy Squared or something.
Yeah.
So, love it.
Something that we, just to kind of round it off with, was offline, we spoke about very briefly, the support that you didn't have or you potentially wish that you could have had. And I know you referenced Pink Elephant as a really awesome support. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was given their pamphlet the day before I was going in to have my D&C. So yeah. I hadn't heard of them before. And sort of all throughout that process, you know, nothing had been presented to me for any kind of supports or organisations to reach out to. So it was, I had like a 4:30 p.m. appointment the day before we booked the D&C, which was just to go over all of the admission and everything like that. And they'd booked me in, you know, 6 a.m. the next morning, but it was 4:30 that night, that afternoon, the day before that I got given the pamphlet, and I wasn't in the headspace then, you know, I needed that prior. And, you know, I just needed to get through another night. I needed to get through to that surgery day to kind of draw a line in the sand and have everything over and done with. So I would have loved to have come across them earlier, and yeah. I've absolutely looked into them and utilised them so much after the fact now as well.
They're incredible.
Resource. They're fantastic. They're doing such big things. And I think the first part of their organisation that I really resonated with was reading some stories. So they just have a page on their website where some women have just shared their stories about loss and miscarriage, and how I was sort of saying earlier that I felt different. You know, I know the stats and I know that now, but I hadn't really heard of, you know, anyone close to us that had had a miscarriage, and, you know, I certainly hadn't heard podcasts that were discussing it, and, you know, nothing had sort of, it's quite taboo to talk about a miscarriage, and, you know, you talk about how far along are you before you tell people, and so I felt as though there wasn't much out there, and I just needed much suffering in silence. And the first thing that really helped was just reading a few of these stories, you know, even if it wasn't someone with a face to the name, it was just a story that was, you know, local and relevant, and it's something that I could feel heard and could feel seen. So that was where it all started, and that really helped me just to, with a little bit of closure, I think, as well. And it would have really helped in those earlier days when I was learning about miscarriages and what that means and how common they are. And that probably would have made me feel a little bit more normal and a little bit more a part of that one in four. Like, you know, it didn't feel like I was one in four. It felt like I was one in a million that this was happening to. And that was really hard. So I just think they're doing amazing things, and you know, they're trying to get a lot of funding now because they're just supporting so many women. And I don't think there's much else out there like them. So, you know, what they offer is just invaluable. So, you know, I have done another podcast on the miscarriage, and so many people reached out to just say thank you for talking about it, because, you know, so many people have said that's like, sounds like you were telling my story. That's exactly what happened with us, you know, getting told at the scan and then getting told to go and see the GP, and, you know, doing it all yourself, as, you know, cancelling the obstetrician appointments and all of that thing, you know, being told these are your options. You have to go and pursue the option now. Like, you have to book it in, or you have to, you know, go and see the GP and then get your referral to the hospital. And, it's. I think there's a lot in being able to share your story just so that someone can resonate with it. I think, you know, that would have been golden for me.
Yeah, and we're so grateful
when we were going through it.
You're here and sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
So thanks so much for your time, and we'll look forward to hearing some happy news towards the early part of next year, 2024.
Don't be ruling that out.
And we might end up getting you back to tell us a little bit about your whole birth story.
Yes, I'd love to. I'd love to. That'd be great.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. If you'd like to suggest a guest or connect and see more of us, then head to Instagram at Baby Baking and Kid Raising. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever listening platform you use. Please note that the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare provider regarding your own pregnancy, birth, and health conditions.